Some killers attack complete strangers. Some target the vulnerable, the young, or the elderly. And some prey on people that they know. There are killers who are inspired by money or by revenge, by sexual deviancy, by hatred. There are opportunists and there are meticulous planners. But what unites these men and women is one simple trait, and it's the most terrifying thing of all. They live amongst us. In our towns, on our streets, in our houses. They're just like the rest of us, but capable of evil. And they could be anywhere. Welcome to Murder Town.
Do you feel it in the air? Oh.
Every corner of the UK has its sinister secrets. Tonight, we're in Watford, a commuter town to the north of London, a town that can sometimes feel like part of the capital.
This was certainly a crime that shook the local community to its core. Women in that area on that day were in such peril, such danger.
If you were in that lane by yourself, you had no chance against anybody.
This was a stranger who had gone out with no other intention than to rape and kill an innocent, helpless young woman.
It was here in the year 2000 that police were preparing to launch a major armed operation.
I was the duty officer, that was the inspector in charge of operational policing in Watford Borough. I remember it was a really hot day, blue sky, and it was around late afternoon, 5:30, 6 o'clock. We were down in this area because there was a very serious incident going on. A lady had been estranged from her husband, had been tracked down by her husband, who was armed with a shotgun, and he wanted to have a serious conversation with her boyfriend. So there was a number of armed officers here.
Police began to take up their positions and sealed off the area, evacuating locals from their houses.
The firearms incident was about to be executed. All set to go. And then I saw a guy in shorts and a T-shirt with a small dog. I was about to tell him to stop where he was because of what was about to take place. He then said, "Who's in charge?" I said, "Well, that's me." And then he quite calmly said, "I found the dead body of a girl around the corner."
Not for the first time, it appeared Watford had played host to a serious crime.
Around that time, there had been a spate of attacks on young girls. All in the vicinity, but it's an urban area, I mean, a lot of people confuse it with London. It has red buses, underground stations, and now people speak. So, yeah, it's the whole panoply. It's burglaries, robberies, sadly, murders. In Hertfordshire terms, it's probably, yeah, the busiest borough.
Now it might be about to get busier, with reports of a woman's body being discovered.
It was just the incongruity of dealing with a serious firearms incident, blazing hot day, and then a guy in a short and T-shirt coming up and saying he's found a dead body of a girl. You don't really expect that. I, with another officer who was a tutor and a probationary officer, we followed him. You can see the traffic lights at the A41. We turned left, past a sort of parade of houses. There is quite a strong correlation, unfortunately, through the number of people who report dead bodies. A significant proportion are actually involved. So all the time we've been talking to the individual, who had to sort of bear that in mind. You carried on, and then there was sort of like a parkland and there was a metal gate. So the four of us and his dog walked until we saw the unfortunately dead body of the young girl. It was clearly a very violent act. There was lots of blood on the front. I mean, it was quite a shocking scene.
Police in Watford were now dealing with a murder inquiry. Very soon, the whole area would be under lockdown and under suspicion. When it comes to murder, there's no corner of Britain that is safe. But there are some places where violence has left an indelible mark that can never be erased.
Watford, being a commuter town, has actually got a very strong sense of community. In many ways, despite its proximity to London, it's a very normal town. There's a lot of green spaces in Watford where people would, you know, go out and walk their dogs, take in the scenery. And in that way, people generally feel quite safe in Watford. I think we have to appreciate that the community where this took place is very close. People tend to, you know, be born here, grow up here, go to school here, and then send their children maybe to the same school that they went to. There's not such a sense of people moving on and going to live elsewhere.
I moved here 24 years ago. It's a very close community, very supportive community. There's a lot of people. If there's, if people need help, they'll help them. Very friendly, very, very friendly area. Pretty much everyone knows each other and argues with each other and enjoys each other's company.
Obviously, we get crime like everybody else, but it's, it's safe. Everybody will help you, no matter what. If you went up to the shops at the Meriden and something happened, somebody will always help you.
Murder is very uncommon everywhere, still, certainly in those days, and it would have hit home to the residents.
But in 2000, a young woman called Anne Cook had been murdered. and word of the violent attack would spread quickly.
She was identified that evening as Anne Cook.
One of the things that really stands out, even now looking back at the case, was just what an ordinary woman Anne Cook was, from a really decent background, living in an ordinary town. She lived with her mum and dad. She had a successful job and was a twin. They are absolutely identical, I mean, completely interchangeable. They used to walk the dog together, in fact, and just before the murder, Susan had moved out to live with her husband, so Anne had only just started walking the dog on her own. She loved walking her dog, she absolutely doted on that dog, and in fact, the dog didn't leave her side when the murder took place. So, you know, we just have a very pleasant, very friendly, but quite private individual who sadly succumbed to such a brutal, brutal crime.
Yeah, I used to see her most days. Sometimes in the morning, lunchtime, whenever I walked my dog. She was very quiet. She was very, very quiet. She would never look you in the eye. She would never speak to you. She would always, as soon as you got closer, she would put her head straight down. She just, like, stayed by herself. And I never actually saw her with anybody, except her little dog.
For this kind of despicable crime to happen on people's doorsteps sent shockwaves through the local community. And these people remember it very, very distinctly, even to this day, and it still gets talked about in this neighbourhood.
It's always a shock when anything like that happens, and you know, to someone so innocent, horrible, horrible crime. People were nervous and worried, and obviously it was a very sad time for their family and for everyone who lived here, really.
Anne lived on the Meriden estate in Watford. A small collection of about 500 homes. It was just a stone's throw from the picturesque Mundon Park where her body was found.
The attack happened about 500 metres away down the Mundon Woods, so it wasn't far away, really.
Well, the Mundon estate is a large parkland estate with a big house sitting in the middle of it that used to be a large manor estate.
It's very picturesque. There are a number of green spaces. It's very much a magnet for people out having a stroll or walking their dogs.
My dog and I walked up there every day. A lot of people used to walk their dogs, and we always used to, like, have a chat, stop and have a chat.
Perhaps a little haven in the middle of quite an urban environment. So people would be forgiven for feeling at peace and for feeling safe in that kind of area.
But now that feeling of safety had been shattered, and police were on the scene.
I'd just arrived home in Bedfordshire and was telephoned by our operations room and asked to attend the incident. I was aware that she'd been found with her dog. I made sure that we got that dog to a vet and took a teeth impression of the dog in case it had bit an offender. I made sure that we had sufficient scenes of crime officers there who could deal with the actual forensic side of the scene. There was also a couple of witnesses that had to be dealt with and be dealt with that night. There was the man who found the body. It's always a good idea to have crucial witnesses like that interviewed and videoed at the time, which is what happened in this case.
The only possible suspect in the first hours of the investigation was the man who said he'd found the body. And if guilty, he wouldn't be the first person in Watford to commit murder. In 2004, Claire Leahy was murdered by her boyfriend, Gary McGovern, in the Leavesden Road. And in 2012, cannabis grower James Evans murdered Murray Thompson in a flat in the town. He would later receive 21 years in prison. But it was the murder of Anne, committed in broad daylight and in a busy public park, that had the police initially stumped.
I think we have to remember that murder is extremely rare. Murder at the hands of a stranger is even more rare. And so, understandably, in the initial period of the police investigation, they had to explore the possibility that Anne's killer was someone that she knew, that was maybe someone closer to home, an ex-partner perhaps. And all of these lines of investigation were very thoroughly explored by the police.
We could begin our work there with the family to find out more of the background and work and boyfriends, computer usage, telephone, everything that we could about Anne to make it easier to investigate what went on.
Police followed up every lead, but they drew a blank. There were no ex-boyfriends who appeared suspicious, and no unusual patterns of behaviour that needed a closer look. But police did find something unusual.
Anne Cook almost had a premonition that something was going to happen to her, so she was almost unusually afraid of being attacked by a stranger, to the extent that a relative had heard her concerns and given her a pocket knife to carry around with her. And it struck me that, you know, living in a place like Watford, at the time, you know, this was quite a heightened level of paranoia, really. And of course, the tragic thing is that her fears came to pass.
But was Anne just being paranoid? Or did she have a reason to fear an attack? With no clues, her twin sister made an appeal for help.
Susan was absolutely distraught by the brutal murder of her sister, and she made a compelling and emotional appeal to the public to help the police track down the killer in the aftermath of the murder. This was a manhunt, and because there was so much media coverage in newspapers, on radio, on TV, it did actually prove pivotal in getting people to come forward with those vital bits of information that the police needed.
Police were given several names, and all of them were checked out. And one witness claimed to have seen something significant.
We were told about a man who was seen running away from the scene across the M1 motorway, which is not that far away, and up the embankment on the other side. He crossed the motorway, which is just behind here, by that fence, through this fence and made off into the estate. I did know that estate, and if the offender was making back to that estate, then he would have gone along some back gardens of the nearest road, and so I therefore had officers immediately go and do some knocking on the doors along that particular road.
The Meriden estate backed onto the park where the body of Anne Cook was found. It's a rabbit warren of dead ends and cut-throughs that only a local person would know. Anne Cook lived in the centre of the estate, and now the whole place was being scoured for clues.
Well, that day, it was a really lovely day, so I took George out early, about 12:30. And then about, I don't know, 5:30, we started hearing helicopters, and then my neighbour said to me, did you see somebody down the bottom of the garden? He was down the bottom of the garden in a vest, and it had blood on it.
On the very night of the offence, this road, all the houses were knocked on to see if there was any immediate witnesses we could find. From then, the day after, every single house on the Merrylands estate, which is quite a few hundred, was visited by uniformed officers on house-to-house inquiries to see who lived there and whether they had any information that they could bring to our attention.
When the police came here, I did say if it was that person that was down the bottom of the garden, it must be somebody off this estate, because nobody knows that you can get there unless you live on this estate. But that would have been the time when we were supposed to walk George that day. So I was so grateful he could have just jumped out the bushes on me.
One thing concerning officers was that this might not be the offender's first attack. Several weeks earlier, two schoolgirls had been sexually assaulted in the same local area. They had survived the attack, and they had described a middle-aged man of medium build with brown hair. But they were yet to find him. Now they were facing the possibility that he'd escalated his offending, and he had to be caught before he struck again.
There were no witnesses to the actual attack. So as well as investigating lines of inquiry that had come in locally, we also had to investigate that this could be someone not from the area. It could be linked with other inquiries around the country. It could be anything.
In the year 2000, police in Watford were hunting for a killer. A young woman called Anne Cook had been found repeatedly stabbed in a local park. Initial inquiries had heard about a man seen running across the adjacent M1 motorway. But there were no immediate suspects, and the community was living in fear, terrified that the killer would strike again.
This crime had a profound effect on the local neighbourhood. You've got to remember that at that time, people were still letting their kids out to play in the evenings. Nothing like this had ever happened before in that area. And suddenly, we have the most grotesque murder taking place on people's doorsteps.
If you were walking up there by yourself, you had to be aware of all your surroundings because it was so quiet. To be quite honest, you was always grateful when you saw somebody coming towards you or another dog walker behind you, and you knew that your walk would be a nice walk because you wouldn't be in that lane by yourself. If you were in that lane by yourself, you had no chance against anybody. I never walked up there again.
The appeals were vital, and the public's response from the estate was vital. We closed the motorway one morning to enable our search team to search it from Verge Central Reservation and the opposite Verge, and some excellent search work on the other side of the motorway from the scene had found a large kitchen knife with blood on.
So police believed that they'd recovered the murder weapon, and while it was sent away for tests, cops continued the hunt for local suspects. Every local resident with a record of violence was added to the list, and police worked through their alibis. One name they were struggling to discount was a local man who lived on the estate called Leon Amos.
People were reporting seeing Leon Amos, or similar to his description, hanging around Mundon all that afternoon, either wearing a T-shirt or bare-chested, wandering about. And then there were sightings of him after the attack. We were aware that Leon Amos, whose parents lived on the estate, he had convictions that were of interest to us.
Indeed, Leon Amos had previous. In 1985, he was sentenced to 8 years for a calculated and planned rape of a teenage girl, subjecting her to a horrific ordeal. He'd strike again on release, attempting to rape another teenage girl and getting 5 more years in prison. But Anne's murder showed no signs of a sexual motive. So police were keen to track down Amos, even if it was simply to rule him out. But they couldn't.
He's normally seen around all the time and had virtually disappeared. He hadn't been seen around. So obviously from that point on, he became a suspect that we wished to trace and interview. But whilst that was going on, there was also lots of other strands of inquiry. So if that didn't pan out, we were positioned well to take the investigation forward in other directions.
Cops were hunting far and wide for any sight of Leon Amos and any other clues that they could uncover. But they were also getting tip-offs from other forces. One possible theory was that a serial killer was on the loose and on the run across Britain. Two women had been killed in Cornwall, and both had been out dog walking. Their deaths were violent, and people began to speculate that a killer was travelling the country. And the notorious murder of Rachel Nickell in Wimbledon was still unsolved. She'd been attacked and stabbed repeatedly in a park, in a crime which bore similarities to Anne. So had Anne been the victim of a serial killer who was moving around the country? Or did the answers to her murder lie in the community in which she lived?
Leon Amos was well known within the local community, not just him, but his family as well. Certainly had a reputation as troublemakers. They were in and out of difficulties with the police and lots of antisocial behaviour and stuff like that.
We spoke to his girlfriend who lived not far away in North Watford, and she said she didn't know where he was, but it was obvious from our inquiries that his brother, Peter Amos, was visiting her and carrying out some chores for Leon.
Police would soon step up their efforts to find Amos after getting a call from the forensics lab, which had been testing the knife found near the scene.
They found Anne Cook's blood on the knife and also Leon Amos's, no one else. So obviously from that point on, he became not just a person of interest, but a suspect. I made the decision and got the proper authority to deploy a surveillance team on the brother Peter, and that surveillance team followed him around for a few days, eventually following him to Houghton Regis in Bedfordshire. It became obvious to us with some further intelligence work that he was staying there with another of his brothers. As a result of excellent work by the surveillance team, we organised a major arrest operation for the following day.
So Les and his team were now hot on the heels of Leon Amos. but he was prepared to do anything he could to evade capture. In 2001, police in Watford were on the hunt for a dangerous killer. He had struck in broad daylight, stabbing a woman repeatedly in a popular local park. Intelligence had led them to a suspect called Leon Amos, but he'd gone to ground. So cops had been following his brothers and had found that one of them could be harboring him in nearby Bedfordshire.
Leon, his parents, who were also involved in the hiding of him, his brother Peter, his brother Jerry, and the girlfriend were all arrested and their premises searched. Leon's father, on arrest and asked where his son Leon was, denied having a son called Leon, which is always amusing. His brother Jerry, who also lived on the Meriden estate, was arrested and his house searched, and Anne Cook's phone, which was also stolen at the time of her murder, was found hidden under the bed in his house.
Police now had their prime suspect in custody. But he wasn't ready to admit his involvement.
Leon came up with a story that he had nothing to do with it. He was just walking past, saw the knife, saw the phone, so he thought he would steal them, and couldn't explain why. He then ran away, took his life in his hands by running across the M1 motorway, threw the knife away but kept the phone, which he gave to his brother, who was expected to sell it for him.
Amos's brothers tried to sell the phone to a group of children, and the children noticed that the phone actually had blood marks on it.
As a result, Leon was charged with murder. His brothers Peter and Jerry were charged with assisting an offender and perverting the course of justice. And they were all remanded in custody pending the trial.
With the men charged, police would learn more about the crime. And they established that Anne Cook had put up a fight.
Anne was a little worried for her safety because the Munden estate can be a lonely place to walk a dog. And up till shortly before the murder, she'd been used to walking with her twin sister. Her twin sister had left home to get married. And so Anne took possession of a small lock knife with which to defend herself if she was attacked. And on this occasion, she did have time to get the knife out as it was found under her body. And she also bravely punched Leon Amos in the eye, giving him a black eye.
In many ways, it seems that Anne Cook was a victim of her youthful looks. She was in her mid-30s, but she looked more like someone in her late teens or early 20s. And Amos had previously attacked young girls who were in their teens, and the police felt very strongly that Amos probably mistook Miss Cook for a much, much younger woman, and that's why he went for her.
When the police told me that she'd been killed, I was so shocked because I thought she was only 14. I thought she was just a young girl. I didn't think she was a woman, I just thought she was a young girl just walking her dog for her mum. That's how young she looked.
This was certainly a crime that shook the local community to its core. This sort of thing doesn't happen very often in places like Watford. This was an estate in particular where people were very close. And that sense of shock that the community felt was prolonged by the fact that it took several days before Amos was apprehended, partly to do with the efforts of his brothers to try and conceal the crime. Both of the brothers actually went back to the scene in an effort to try and recover the knife. So this certainly made matters a whole lot worse for the community, but of course, Anne Cook's family.
Despite denying the charges, police were confident that they would get a guilty verdict at trial.
I'd covered dozens of court cases, dozens of murders up until that point in my career, but this one did stand out because there was a real sense of tension in the court. There were a large number of witnesses because a lot of people had actually seen Miss Cook and had seen Amos in the area at the time, so the prosecutors wanted to be very thorough and let the jury hear from these people.
The trial was fought vigorously by the defence counsel for Leon Amos and the defence counsels for the two brothers, Peter and Jerry. They all pleaded not guilty, and a long trial ensued.
Amos refused to take the stand, but a jury heard claims that he was a man of low intelligence who'd been nothing more than a curious passerby. But even Amos would struggle to explain how the murder weapon belonged to a set of knives and how the rest of the set had been found at his girlfriend's home.
All the evidence came out. The knife was displayed. The full set of the rest of the knives were recovered from Leon Amos's girlfriend's house, and they could be displayed in court with the one that was used for the murder missing.
Being a jury in a case like this is an extremely difficult thing to do. These are just ordinary men and women who have ordinary lives, and yet here they were, day after day, having to look at the most horrendous images and the most distressing photos of Anne's body.
He went out on that day, armed with a big knife, to attack, I'm quite sure, to rape an innocent woman.
Just unthinkable to contemplate how women in that area on that day were in such peril, such danger.
And unfortunately, on this occasion, she fought back, and it led to him stabbing her and killing her.
I was watching Amos very closely in the dock, and he never showed any emotion. His face was expressionless. He stared into the distance. Even when the jury came back and delivered their verdict, sending this man to prison for a very, very long time, he stood completely impassively. It was very chilling. It was a very cold individual. The jury of 12 men and women who convicted Amos did so on the evidence that they heard about Anne's killing, specifically about Anne's killing. What they didn't know when they delivered that guilty verdict was that this depraved individual had been guilty of sex attacks on young women before. The judge in the case was very clear that Amos was one of the worst kind of sexual predators and a danger to all young women. This was a stranger who had gone out with no other intention than to rape and kill an innocent, helpless young woman. And certainly the police felt that by bringing him to justice, they had undoubtedly saved lives.
Leon Amos was given a life sentence and told he would spend at least 20 years behind bars. And his brothers were also found guilty of assisting an offender and perverting the course of justice. Watford could finally breathe easier as a killer was sent down.
Well, the relief for the estate was that a dangerous criminal who put more than just Anne Cook's life at risk, he put other people's lives at risk while he was still free. So it was a relief to the estate. It was a relief to the family that someone was convicted of killing their beloved daughter. And it was a relief to me and the Hertfordshire Constabulary. A lot of effort had gone into it from a lot of people, and it was important that we make the community feel safe by putting that Leon Amos away where he belonged, behind bars.
An enduring sadness to this case is that whilst a whole family has lost a beautiful, caring sister and daughter, one can only think what it must be like for Anne's sister, Susan, who has had to carry on with her life without the identical twin that she was so close to, so attached to, and how every time she looks in the mirror, it must be a reminder of the beautiful sister that she's lost.
Every murder is tragic and senseless. But this case, with a victim who was simply in the wrong place at the wrong time, is perhaps the most terrifying of all. It's sometimes described as a shark attack, the idea of a predator launching an assault with no warning and no way out. Sadly, these sharks can be almost anywhere. And in a murder town, you never know when they might strike.